I mean, one of the things that I'm thankful for, actually, is that my kids go to a school and that they're not on their phone for those 6 hours, right? They're interacting in groups, doing chemistry lab, doing what have you. So there are places, you know, where the phones kind of get tucked away in the pocket or whatever, yeah. And they are having the face-to-face.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight we will be looking at the urgent and ubiquitous problem of social isolation. This growing epidemic, which is the root cause of many serious health problems, persists at a time when we are supposedly more digitally connected than ever before. Do Americans treat the issue seriously enough, and what steps can we take to alleviate loneliness in our own lives and in the lives of those around us? To help us examine several aspects about loneliness and friendship, we have the benefit of a panel of four great minds. Dr. Terry Freiberg, a social psychologist and author of The Four Seasons of Loneliness. Dr. Amy Banks, a psychiatrist at Wellesley Centers for Women and author of Wired to Connect, The Surprising Link Between Brain Science and Strong Healthy Relationships. Professor Sandy Pentland, who directs the MIT Connection Science and Human Dynamics Lab, and who's written a book entitled Social Physics, How Social Networks Can Make Us Smarter, and Princeton Professor of Philosophy, Alexander Nahamas, who has just published a book entitled On Friendship. So, just taking things up a step to our social networks that everybody belongs to, and you have these scores of followers on Facebook. How does the social network differ from this community, this sense of community? What is it that the social network might be able to give us, and what can it not provide us?
Well, I think a very serious difference between a face-to-face friendship and anything that we have in the social media is the following. What we produce when we are in a social media situation is always aspects of ourselves or facts about our lives that are public. They're general descriptions that are, in principle, available to everyone. Of course, we have our friends and all that sort of thing, but in principle, they are things that we could tell everyone. When you're in a face-to-face relationship, you're not engaging in generalities with one another. You're treating each other as a very specific individual. And that's extremely important for me. When you're in Facebook, you're not dealing with people as individuals. You're dealing with them as people who have this particular kind of politics, this particular kind of humor, and all that. There are categories that you put them in. Whereas when you're dealing with a friend, categories don't really work. So that if you ask me why it is that I like you on account of the fact that you're intelligent, say, and I say, well, I like her because she's intelligent, then you say, well, yeah, but, you know, Einstein is more intelligent. Why don't you love him instead? I will go back, I'll take a step back and say, oh, it's not just intelligence, like it's her particular intelligence, or the way she is intelligent. And that's just a manner of speaking that suggests that it's this particular individual in its uniqueness, so to speak, mm-hmm. that I am appreciating and loving. So, and that you don't get in the social media.
So when we look at social media, what we find is we find people try to analyze it in terms of, you know, what are the positive or negative, you know, emotion, what are the attitudes. It turns out that it's very faddish. The way people express themselves mm-hmm. is very socially determined, so mm-hmm. it's exactly as you said. The right. things you put on social media are the things you want other people to see. Right. It's the things you want, it's the face you want to put forward. On the other hand, the things that you actually do, where you spend time, your most valuable resource, is a very strong indicator of who you are and what you value. It's very hard to fake things like where you go, where you spend time with, who you actually interact with. And one of the things that I like to do is ask people, have you ever had a large sort of deal or big change in your life, something we made an arrangement, where you didn't actually also have a meal with a person? And across every culture that I've ever heard of, and everybody I've ever asked, the answer is no, that's actually interesting. Right. When I have some big thing like that, yeah. I'll have a lunch with them or a dinner before or after, and it gives me that sense of connection. That's a complete, you know, objectively, logically, that's a completely silly and random thing, but it's a real universal, because the act of eating with somebody reveals so much about what makes them tick, the sort of person they are, that you can now feel comfortable with this new relationship that you've done.
You know, I wanted to mention something else that isn't so much Facebook-oriented, but I remember a number of years ago when I was sort of really, you know, thinking about, the pathways for connection and how they're built and what goes wrong with them. I remember seeing my, at the time, probably about 12-year-old daughter getting an Instagram from a friend, right? And I saw her see it, as I'm watching, it completely filled her whole body. I mean, and it was really remarkable, and I sort of remember thinking at the time, what's interesting is that people who have spent those early years and have good face-to-face connections really can augment and stimulate those pathways for connection with these small-scale, you know, Instagram, right? Mm-hmm. It embodies. It's like our relationships live inside of us in these pathways. And then we can kind of have the shorthand of a, you know, a text message or Instagram or Facebook. But the opposite can happen. The kids who don't have that, who really are kind of lost socially, there is nowhere near enough information in a text or in a Instagram or just a picture to really tell them what they need to know about the relationship, right? Those kids are going to get lost.
Well, one of the phenomena that's very worrisome to me is that now sort of online gaming and virtual reality stuff is good enough that if you're not somebody who has actual connections with people, you see a whole generation of people that use that as a sort of synthetic relationship.
Yep.
And so that gives rise to, you know, people living in the basement with a screen on and not much else going on in their lives.
Right.
I would like to say that connections on Facebook are always content motivated. In other words, if I have something to say, I will put it out. Yeah. Whereas in a personal situation, very often what matters is not what it is that you do together, but that you do it together. Whatever it is. And in fact, when you see good friends interacting with them, and most of the time we're not saving each other's lives.
Right.
Most of the time we gossip, we talk about politics and love affairs and you know what we saw last night or whatever. Yep. And it doesn't really matter. But the thing is, even though the subjects may not be important, the connection is.
Yep. That's right.
So that's one thing that we miss. On the other hand, I think things like Facebook or Instagram are very good for maintaining friendships that I think we would not be able to do otherwise. It's so you don't begin a friendship by and large on Facebook, but a friendship that might atrophy otherwise can survive because you're still keeping in touch. So, you know, there are some aspects that we should be able to look at and see, you know, they're not that bad, and we might be able to exploit them and use them in a way, rather than letting the programmers do it all for us.
So talking about the value of social networking and what really people are talking about now when they say, oh, I've got X number of friends. Really, one can probably only have about 4 or 5 quality friendships at any given time. That's what I think the research shows, real, true friendships. What constitutes a true friend, and is this something that's now changing?
I think of friendship as a relationship that covers everything from the closest, most intense relationship to acquaintances with whom we interact only a few times over several years or whatever. In philosophy, for better or worse, people have divided friendships into friendships where you actually love the person themselves and friendships where you like the person or are attracted to the person because of the pleasure that you get out of the relationship or the profit that you get out of the relationship.
Mm.
My view is that this is a huge mistake. Relationships that have pleasure or profit as their purpose are instrumental relationships. They are, if I want to get something from you, I'm not going to change in a relationship because I want you to do something for me. I have a desire. I know where the desire is. I ask you for it to satisfy it. You do. I'm back where I was before.
Mm-hmm.
But with a friend, a real friend, a close friend, you don't know where you're going to go. You don't have any specific reason for participating in activities with that person, for spending time. Mm-hmm. The reason is that you like them or that you get closer and closer, that you love them. So I think the affective aspect, from love to my liking, is absolutely essential to friendship. Yeah. Of course, a good friend always helps as well. My best friend always comes to our house and fixes up things, because I don't do that. I help him with his clothes. Right? I mean, there's mm-hmm. a specialization mm-hmm. here, a division of labor. And, you know, he gives me great pleasure too, but there's another reason why we're friends. Right. The reason is that I love him.
Interesting. But what happens, I wonder, when an entire generation of people are now raising all their development and their knowledge of people based on these shallow interactions on the internet? Perhaps one's whole, if you're 30, dating history has started from looking at people's profiles and going backwards then and finding out after you hook up with them if you've got anything in common with them. Mm-hmm. It's almost as like we're doing things completely in reverse. And, you know, we get the cake and then we work out if we like the ingredients. And it's a very strange...
I have to remember that.
It's a very exactly. strange situation.
So, Go ahead. So... I'm not so quick to say that it's wrong. I mean, I you know, my son assures me that, you know, technology is exactly where it should be, and it's going to be continuing to be doing this all along. So there's certainly a change afoot, right? But I'm not willing yet to say that how I was raised or the way that I saw relationships then is necessarily what I need to be applying to my children, right? I see them building relationships in different ways that is very integrative of the technology in a way that I can't do because it wasn't there when I was born. It wasn't in my mind. It wasn't in my brain. It's not wired to me in that way. Do you know what I mean? And, I mean, I think there's risk. I don't want to say that there isn't risk, but, you know, I would like to have the question be, okay, in this generation, what is good about these relationships? You know, what's working? Mm-hmm. With the technology, what is working in our ability to, you know, not have to date 25 people, but to sift out by certain characteristics, right? Yeah. And say, okay, you know, I needed to know this up front, and I didn't have to have 10 dates to find it out, right? You know, so to
I think my question is, can you fast forward through the process? Is building a friendship something that takes time?
It does. Yeah. It does. Aristotle said that.
Yeah. Did he?
Yeah, he said it's very, very easy to start liking somebody, but very takes a long time to become friends. For one thing, he says exactly that. He says friends have to spend a lot of their time together.
Right.
And that's not what happens here.
Yeah.
As I said, it's not all bad or anything like that, and I think it's very important that we try to look at the good things that are coming along with
it. But I have one thing that I've been on about recently that it's not exactly loneliness, but it's related to it. It has to do with isolation. For instance, in the recent election, we saw that very different communities in the United States were not even aware that the other existed.
Yeah.
And they're very angry about it. Mm-hmm. And they have completely different theories of the world. And you have to say, well, how did that happen? And it's obvious that they're talking to themselves, but not to each other.
Right. Right.
And then you cross that with the fact that in this country, the rate of segregation by income, rich people don't talk, don't live with, don't see, don't experience poor people don't experience rich people. It's a little bit like loneliness in the sense that there's this disconnection, this physical, rich disconnection between people. And as a consequence, conversation is completely at odds, too.
I guess the ultimate question is, if we raise an entire generation who just texts and who has this sort of shallow interaction, what are we breeding? A sort of utilitarian connection. You know, I need this, I talk to you, I show you this picture, I get this. But what are we doing in terms of raising the bar, in terms of treating people as mature individuals, raising this person so that they are not dependent on that they can operate without text and without the internet. They can actually have a conversation, that they're not going to be socially inept. Is that a concern for any of you?
It's a concern for me. I mean, there is a book that I'm sure you guys have read called The Shallows that is sort of on the verge of this, and it talks about sort of the superficial layer that we all are in, that people that are so embedded in all of this technology and social media and all of that is, you know, our attention spans are like this, and the relationships do suffer, the face-to-face, the skills, because you're really talking about these interpersonal, there's skills, you know, and, you know, my thought is we need to, you know, keep teaching those skills. And I think, it, you know, there's room for it in school. I mean, one of the things that I'm thankful for, actually, is that my kids go to a school and that they're not on their phone for those 6 hours, right? They're interacting in groups, doing chemistry lab, doing what have you. So there are places, you know, where the phones kind of get tucked away in the pocket or whatever, and they are having the face-to-face. And, you know, certainly, you know, I try to get my kids to have face-to-face. So I think, yes, of course, if you're not working those pathways of looking at somebody's face and reading and stimulating the mirror neurons and, you know, all of that, it is going to suffer. It's just simply the way our brains are wired, right? If we're not stimulating those pathways, they're going to get weaker. And we're going to be less good at it. You know, I think that face-to-face has to continue to be built in the earliest days of schooling, and certainly at home.
So is one of the answers in terms of how do we solve this problem of chronic loneliness, is it being more and more plugged into groups?
Well, so if you look at the way people are educated in Western society, it's really appalling.
Yeah.
I mean, so you know, when you're in kindergarten, what are you taught? Well, you're taught to sit still, keep your hands to yourself, and shut up.
Yep.
Like, well, you know, for instance, in Montessori, not the, you know, pump Montessori, but, you know, the kids run around from place to place, and they interact with each other. And we have some evidence that it's that interacting with the peers that is the thing that makes Montessori as successful as it is, which is quite successful. And what's interesting also is that several countries now, Vietnam is the one that I'm most closely related to, have actually put social skills as a primary goal for education from the various earliest ages. So you have to know how to work in a group in kindergarten, because it's these soft skills, so-called, that are actually central.
Yeah.
And I think one thing that family can do is insist on connective rituals, like the family dinner. Imagine in Jewish history the importance of Friday nights, where the family automatically gathers every Friday night and shares the meal and the ritual. And this having ritual is the psychological equivalent with respect to the topic of loneliness of a life raft on a boat or something. When you have ritual to go back to with friends or with family, and making that happen, and that's what doesn't happen over social media because it's one-to-one. But and young girls and women are very good at this, arguably better than guys, about getting together and sharing and talking in a ritualistic way, the Saturday lunch or whatever the ritual might be for a given group, about matters that are important to them. And I think it's important for modern families to insist on, for example, family dinners or a weekend together or the vacation together and the phones are down, because that kind of connective ritual is what people fall back on or don't have it to fall back on, and it makes all the difference in the world when trouble strikes.
Well, thank you all very much. If people would like to come up and pose questions, feel free.
My question is about how space is created between people.
How what?
How space?
Space?
Is created between people. I'm just wondering if the sort of psychic and social domains can be thought of in an ontology of space.
Well, I think space is both something that you create between people and something that you also reduce between people, right? And it's not clear to me where we begin. It's not clear to me that where we begin is in a place where we are completely bonded, so to speak, with the mother, and we gradually start distancing ourselves from other people, or whether both the desire to belong and the desire to stand apart, because I'm not that much against individuals, I must say. I think we've badmouthed individuals a little too much tonight. But the thing is that I think we have both needs, not just the need to belong. We also have the need to stand out. And it's very important to be able to stand out. I don't think we here would feel the way we do. If we're the same people, right? Yeah. I mean, you write one kind of book, you write another kind of book, I write another kind of book. Yeah. We all need to separate ourselves because we are absolutely, as you said, pack animals, right? We're herd animals, as Nietzsche said, and the safest position to be is right in the middle. You don't have to, if you're too weak, the lions will eat you. If you're too strong, you get first to the ravine or the river, and the wildebeest that come behind you smash you. So the best place to be is in the middle. And I think to some extent, that's what I would sort of put forward as a view here, is that we need to be able to balance the two. So how you create space, I'm not sure how you do that. I really don't know how you do it. But I do know that we do create space and that it's essential for us to be human beings that we have to have that. We can't just identify, in other words.
I think you're right, and I wondered, you know, whether the paranoia that parents have now about their children, even though the world is not so much more scary than it was when we were all growing up and we had so much independence, yeah, that paranoia is perhaps a byproduct of too much social isolation and loneliness. And that everybody gets kind of carried away with the newspaper article that says somebody was kidnapped, and they refuse to notice that their neighborhood is incredibly safe.
It used to be you never heard about the 30 people in Nepal who went off the cliff. Now you hear about it, and it actually affects the way people think here that something like that happened. So we're having this increased awareness of disasters everywhere, and it raises
everybody's
heightened
angst.
Fear, yeah.
Right. So,
but I can't say that it's bad, though, because we ought to, you know, take care of that stuff. But, yeah, in the meantime, we're stressed to death.
Right. I think there's some very interesting cultural differences between the couple of countries that I know outside of this one. France, for example, which has a lot more cohesiveness. It only has about half as much measured chronic loneliness as this country. It has a lot more of these connective of family events and so on, the importance of the meal in French culture. So what did the French do with the terrorist at the Bataclan and those murders? They were out in those cafes the next night.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's something I think we would not have seen here.
Yeah, that's true.
There's an interesting paradox. Loneliness actually something to do with being alone. And yet we are trying to talk about the group and the society. So we need to pay attention to what loneliness is also. People feel lonely when they're alone. And I have seen people in my own practice and work when people can connect with themselves. And there are ways to do that. Meditation is one. Passionate involvement with the cause or with creativity. Doesn't have to be individual people-oriented. I'm saying just the opposite from what I have been hearing. We don't need group activity in everything. Certain things, of course, we have to build something, a bridge. We need group people. We need a meeting like this with group people. However, there are times when we have to be alone and we have to connect with ourselves and we have to know who we are. And the Eastern philosophers said that, which is much older, said that for a long, long time that you have to know yourself. And it's not easy to do that. But if one is connected to oneself by various methods, and creativity is the most important one, and a passionate creativity, then I think those people are much, much less lonely. And they don't even need outside. So to solve it only through extroverted means, no matter how sophisticated the research things are, not going to solve it. And going back to the media, social media and the technology, I think the problem with technology is that is the face-to-face connection is so much reduced. And children, sometimes I see on the subway looking at their iPhones when the train goes over the river from here to Boston. And I sometimes tell jokingly, have you seen the beautiful sunset? The kids will say, oh, yeah, really, it's true, yeah. And but then back to the thing again. So it's like, and also loneliness is different at different age group. The teenagers feel loneliness very differently than somebody my age or a middle-aged person or in between. So when we are older, and some of the people in this room perhaps would agree with me, we need loneliness sometimes. We need solitude. We don't want to deal with too many people, and people choose to do so. So before we conclude on these things or research, we have to also distinguish the aspects of different aspects of loneliness, and we also want to be alone sometimes. So both sides should be considered.
Right. I mean, there's the idea of being alone and the idea of the balance between a proper individuality where you're able to be alone without feeling lonely, and on the other hand, having the security of connections is an important distinction. But another fact is, in 1970, 17% of adult households in the United States were single-person households. In 2012, it was 27%. That's a lot. That's a lot of increase, huh? And so not much less than a third of American households are now single-person households. Are they lonely or are they in solitude? Are they at peace? If we make that distinction between people who are at peace with being alone, I use the word solitude for that, and I try to distinguish that in my book from people who are aching with loneliness. Yeah. Professor Olds, who just spoke, has a wonderful line in her book. I think it was 35%, I could be wrong on that statistic, of people report that they have spoken to no one in the past 6 months about anything of importance.
Of course, definitely. I'm not saying that individualism solves the problem, but we have to include both because we have a hankering for both in our human
need. Yeah, and you know what I would add to this is that I think that people who actually, when your neural pathways for connection actually have been stimulated, your sense of connectedness, not just to other people, but to the bigger whole. For some people, it's religion. For some people, it's whatever. But you can be in solitude because you're held within something.
Exactly.
Right? And that is a whole regulatory system that comes about through connection to something meaningful.
If you look at the way society moves and the changes that have made, it almost seems like we're fighting a wave of technology that honestly doesn't make any sense to fight because it may be inevitable that we end up in this social media environment. So you spoke about health issues. Those things, as we evolve as humans and develop that type of lifestyle, perhaps we won't see as much of that. Obesity may not be a problem. I don't know. I don't really like the idea of it. But we're making assumptions with statistics based on current conditions and current things that are happening with people. We can't understand what the ramifications of this technology will be. The phone was a great example, but TV, we looked at TV, and we said, well, you know, you watch TV, you're going to lose.
You're not in the movies, you're in TV.
You know. Yeah, and the phone, of course, you know, you're not speaking to somebody. So maybe this isn't a bad thing. Perhaps it will change the way we deal with each other, but it won't be catastrophic.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's what I just wanted to.
Thank you.
That's a good point.
Well, I just wanted to say thank you to all our eminent professors and psychologists who enriched us and philosophers this evening with various viewpoints. And please come again and have a pleasant evening. You have been listening to Loneliness in the Digital Age, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square in December 2016. We are co-sponsored by the Lowell Institute, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, and Friends of the Cambridge Forum. The ancients believed that friendship bound the universe together. We hope they are right. Thank you for joining us, and do come again.